that the president would seek to influence an ongoing criminal investigation, the FBI director left the meeting and immediately started typing a memo documenting Trump's extraordinary request, a practice he had begun with the new president. Then on March 20th, Comey appeared before the House Intelligence Committee and gave testimony that was devastating for Trump. He confirmed for the first time there was an ongoing counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to the Russians, and that it had been going on since the previous July. Comey was asked about Trump's recent tweet claiming that Obama had had my wires tapped at Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism. The claim seemed preposterous on its face, and was yet another Trump attempt to deflect attention. Still, if Trump Tower had been tapped, it would have been the FBI's job to do it. Comey said the FBI and the Justice Department has no information that supports those tweets. The FBI director had, for all intents and purposes, just called the president a fabulist. Trump was now obsessed with one goal, getting Comey to publicly say he was not under investigation. The Russia scandal was complicating his job as president. During a phone call, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi had asked Trump about the investigation, according to a White House official. The fact that a foreign leader would raise the issue incensed Trump. On March 30th, Trump called Comey and told him he had nothing to do with Russia and had not been involved with hookers there. What could Comey do, he asked, to lift the cloud? Comey had already privately briefed congressional leaders on the Bureau's probe, identifying the players who were under investigation, and this did not include Trump. But to state that publicly would create a problem. What happens if something changed? Would Comey need to publicly announce that as well? The FBI once again sidestepped the request and told Trump the Bureau would do its work as quickly as we could. On April 11th, Trump called Comey and made the same request, asking if he would get out the fact Trump was not a direct target. Comey politely told Trump he should have the White House counsel take the matter up with the Justice Department. On May 9th, while he was visiting the FBI's Los Angeles field office, Comey looked up at a TV set and learned that he had been fired. The White House initially said it was because Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had written a memo criticizing Comey for his handling of the Clinton email investigation. But Trump quickly contradicted that in a meeting with Russian officials. The morning after the firing, he had a jovial get-together at the White House with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. There were smiles all around. "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy, a real nut job," Mr. Trump told them, according to notes of the meeting. "I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off." The next day, Trump told NBC News anchor Lester Holt that he had in mind this Russia thing when he dismissed Comey. Jared Kushner reportedly had told his father-in-law that if he dumped Comey, Democrats would cheer the move. But Trump's firing of Comey backfired. Immediately, there were questions as to whether the president was seeking to obstruct justice. As Bannon had warned Trump, "You can fire the FBI director, but you can't fire the FBI." By this point, the Russia scandal had already upended his administration. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, facing a storm of criticism over his failure to disclose his own contacts with Kislyak during the campaign, had recused himself from the investigation. Trump was angered by Sessions's move. He wanted his own guy, a loyal guy, in charge. "Where's my Roy Cohn?" Trump vented to his aides at one point. Instead, Rosenstein was now overseeing the probe, and he soon tapped the 72-year-old Mueller to get to the bottom of the Russian affair. Mueller was the worst possible pick for Trump. He was a ramrod-straight Marine veteran who had served as FBI director for 12 years. According to friends and colleagues, Mueller had one supreme passion in life: making criminal cases and putting malefactors behind bars. Trump's witch hunt approach made it much tougher for the Republican-led Congress to do its job and investigate the Russia scandal. Excessive partisanship had already poisoned Capitol Hill. Now, with Trump insisting there was nothing to investigate, many of his Republican comrades demonstrated little desire for digging deep into the Russia attack and any Trump-Moscow connections. No special committees were formed. The relevant panels did not greatly expand staff resources, were reluctant to use their subpoena power, and in many instances, only conducted a cursory review of documents. Most important, throughout 2017, they conducted all their interviews of key witnesses in private. A major purpose of congressional investigations for decades, from Teapot Dome to Watergate to Iran-Contra to the campaign finance abuses of the 1990s, was to educate the country through public hearings. Yet the Russian probes were being conducted almost entirely behind closed doors. Several key Republicans were focused not on pursuing Trump's ties to the Russians, but on Glenn Simpson and Christopher Steele's ties to the Democrats. Note, in early 2018, two Republican senators would ask the Justice Department to investigate Steele for allegedly making false statements to the FBI. For the Republican leaders, the goal appeared to be to protect Trump and get through it as fast as possible, before the midterm congressional elections of 2018. End of note. Mueller's appointment, though, guaranteed that a fierce and thorough investigation on the part of the FBI would continue, unless Trump tried to stop it. Mueller signed up prosecutors experienced in bringing organized crime, money laundering, cybercrime, and white-collar crime cases, and they went to work. As all the investigations proceeded, news broke of the Trump Tower meeting in June 2016, when Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner talked with Natalia Veselnitskaya, the Kremlin emissary, in the expectation she was bringing them derogatory information on Clinton. Trump Jr. and the White House, with the president's participation, put out misleading explanations of the meeting, an episode that caused Trump critics to suggest the Trump team had committed another obstruction of justice. Manafort's home was raided by federal agents. Evidence of Moscow's wide-ranging covert social media campaign surfaced. In October, Mueller indicted Manafort and Rick Gates on 12 counts, including money laundering and failure to file as registered foreign agents for their work on behalf of Yanukovych's pro-Russia party. As soon as the indictments were announced, the White House began distancing itself from Manafort, claiming the charges had nothing to do with the campaign or any interactions with Russia. Yet, on the same day, before this spin could take hold, Mueller announced that Papadopoulos had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts during the campaign with Russians. Here was another example of the Trump campaign at least trying to interact with the Kremlin. Information about Manafort's contacts with Deripaska, Page's trip to Moscow, Kushner's meeting with a Russian banker, the 2016 Trump Tower meeting, and Trump's attempt to develop a Moscow tower with Felix Sater during the campaign had already come out. But the Papadopoulos plea agreement was the first official confirmation that there had been ongoing private or secret communications between a Trump campaign advisor and the Russians. And a month later, Mueller announced a plea deal with Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, who had led the chant of lock her up at the Republican convention, admitted he had lied to FBI agents about his conversations with Kislyak. Flynn had been indicted on only two counts. He was cooperating with Mueller. But the question was, what information was he sharing with Mueller, and who might it implicate? Throughout it all, Trump fumed about the investigation. In fits of rage, he vowed to fire Mueller, and GOP lawmakers were attacking the probe. But Trump's lawyers, including John Dowd and Ty Cobb, two Washington criminal defense veterans, talked him down, assuring the president that Mueller's probe would finish quickly. It would be over soon, they told him. A few weeks later, they would say that again. And then again, the deadlines came and went. For all the public controversy, there was still much about Putin's cyber attacks that was cloaked in mystery, especially what had happened in Russia. 5 days after Trump's inauguration, the Russian business newspaper Kommersant published an eye-popping story. Sergei Mikhailov, the deputy director of the FSB's Center 18, its main unit assigned to investigate cybercrimes, had been secretly arrested after the U.S. election. He had been grabbed during a meeting at his FSB office and dragged out with a bag on his head. He was charged with treason. So too was one of his deputies, a stocky criminal hacker turned government agent named Dmitry Dokuchayev. Other Russian media reported the men had been accused of having been informants for U.S. intelligence, tipping off the FBI to Russia's hacks of state election systems during the election. Note. In March 2017, Dokuchayev was one of two FSB officers charged in the United States for being part of one of the largest cyber attacks in history, the Russian penetration of Yahoo's email network, which resulted in the theft of data from 500 million email users around the globe. End of note. Meanwhile, a former FSB general, Oleg Yerovinkin, a top deputy to Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin, who figured prominently in Steele's dossier, was found dead in his car in the center of Moscow, purportedly of a heart attack. This fueled speculation of foul play that might be related to Steele's memos. And in May, Igor Almyashev, a researcher who had worked at a top-secret institute known to have developed advanced surveillance technologies, was shot in the head in the restroom of a Moscow restaurant. Western media did not cover the story, but Steele noticed a Russian news report. He saw this murder as a reminder of the danger facing those who worked in Russian government and intelligence and who might be fingered as disloyal, a reason he had consistently refused to reveal the identities of his sources for the dossier. Putin's regime was still bent on revenge. In one of its last acts, the Obama administration had expanded the list of Russians sanctioned under the Magnitsky Act to include the two former FSB officers who had poisoned Alexander Litvinenko in London in 2006. A few weeks later, in an event Russian dissidents suspected was connected, Vladimir Kara-Murza, a Russian human rights activist who had lobbied for this law, was rushed to a hospital gagging for air and fell into a coma. He survived, but the diagnosis was chilling. Toxic action by an undefined substance. It was the second time he had been poisoned. Trump, who never got to meet Putin when he was in Moscow for the Miss Universe pageant in 2013, finally had the chance now that he was the president. The first time came in July at a G20 summit in Hamburg. The two men displayed warm smiles as they shook hands in front of a phalanx of reporters. Trump said it was an honor to meet the Russian president. Putin said he was delighted to see Trump. There was a very close personal chemistry, said Tillerson, who sat in on their meeting. The session lasted more than 2 hours and covered a wide range of issues, including Syria. Trump, according to Tillerson, pressed Putin about the concerns of the American people regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election. Putin denied any meddling, and Trump moved on, Tillerson said, putting aside an intractable disagreement at this point. That night, during a grand dinner for all 20 world leaders, Trump got up from his table and walked over to Putin's and sat down. They talked again for about an hour. Nobody else was present, other than Putin's English translator. Following his talks with the Russian leader, Trump said that it was time to move forward with Russia, and that he and Putin had agreed to set up an impenetrable cybersecurity unit so that election hacking and many other negative things will be guarded and safe. After all that had happened in 2016, the idea of Russian-American cooperation on cybersecurity was immediately derided by members of Congress as absurd. "It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close," Senator Lindsey Graham remarked. Trump quickly dropped the proposal. In November, Trump and Putin met again at an Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Vietnam. They talked during the event, and Trump asked Putin once more about Russia's meddling in the election. As Trump told reporters on Air Force One, "He said he didn't meddle. He said he didn't meddle. I asked him again. You can only ask so many times." Trump continued, "Every time he sees me, he says, 'I didn't do that.' And I believe, I really believe that when he tells me that, he means it." He added, "I think he is very insulted by it." Trump had gotten the answer he wanted. This had been a crime and an act of covert warfare. Yet Trump seemed more worried about Putin's reaction than Putin's attack. During the campaign, Trump had encouraged Russia's hacking and dumping, of which he was the chief beneficiary. He had praised the WikiLeaks releases, promoting them, and calling for more, even after he had received a secret U.S. government briefing stating that the cyber break-ins and the dissemination of Democratic files were part of a Russian covert operation to undermine the election. All signs indicated Trump would not exact revenge if Moscow's intervention succeeded in helping him reach the White House. He had spoken positively about Putin and suggested he was eager to undo sanctions and cut deals with the Kremlin, even as the Russian information warfare campaign was underway. Whether or not the investigations would ever turn up hard evidence of collusion, Trump's actions, his adamant and consistent denial of any Russian role, had provided Putin cover. In that sense, he had aided and abetted Moscow's attack on American democracy. Now, after his second meeting with Putin, Trump was done raising the subject with the Russian leader. There would be no penalties for Putin, and nothing to stop him from doing it again. But Trump's own unsettling conduct guaranteed the Russia scandal was far from over. For Mueller, Congress, and the American people. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. Written by Michael Isikoff and David Korn. Read by Peter Ganim. Produced by Lisa Kahn. Recorded by Patrick Smith at Audio Media Production. Post-production by John Colucci. Russian Roulette is available in print and digital formats from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Michael Isikoff and David Korn. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.